Welcome to Inspiration and Transformation from the Banks of the Ganga with Sadhvi Bhagwati Saraswati, an American sannyasi living at the Parmarth Nikatan Ashram in Rishikesh, India. Sadhvi is president of the Divine Shakti Foundation, a charitable organization bringing education, vocational training, upliftment, and empowerment programs to women and children. Sadhvi is also Secretary General of the Global Interfaith WASH Alliance and Director of the world-famous International Yoga Festival. Join the musings of an American sannyasi as Sadhvi shares the wisdom and teachings of her guru, His Holiness Pujya Swami Chidanand Saraswatiji.
Welcome, everyone, to Inspiration and Transformation from the Holy Banks of the sacred Ganga River in the land of Rishikesh, India. We live in a world where temptations are rocketing from all sides. How do we strengthen the intellect to control the mind? Well, let's talk about temptations. Why are they so difficult to overcome? I mean, we've got so many temptations in the world, but they fall into only a few categories. They're all things that make us feel better, or we think will make us feel better. So temptations to eat things we shouldn't eat, temptations to drink things we shouldn't drink, temptations to maybe have relations with people with whom we shouldn't have relations. Those are the most superficial layer. If I eat that, I will feel good. If I drink that, I will feel good. If I smoke that, I will feel good. If I engage in sensual pleasures with this person, I will feel good. Outer layer of temptations. And they're very difficult for a lot of people. I remember a personal story. When I was young, my mother was always on a diet. It's just sort of what people in Los Angeles do. Everybody diets. And my mother's always been very, very thin, but nonetheless, she was always on a diet. And I remember one time we had gone out to eat, and my dad is someone who has always really loved desserts. Now, he's got great discipline. He's a very healthy eater, but you're on vacation. We had gone to Palm Springs for vacation, and we had gone out for a nice dinner. And my dad ordered a hot fudge sundae for dessert. And he and my mom were sitting next to each other in the booth, and I was on the other side. And my dad is also very, very methodical and slow. Not slow in a mentally slow way, but just slow in a very calm way, very peaceful, takes his time. And my mother's much more kind of frenetic energy. And so they're sitting together, the hot fudge sundae comes, my dad is just surveying it, maybe taking in how beautiful it looks. And my mom, by this point, has already picked up her spoon and is eating my dad's hot fudge sundae. And of course, you know, he's very happy to share. The thing was huge. And by the time my dad actually has picked up his spoon to have his first bite, my mom has already had two or three or four bites. And then she decided, that's enough. Like, I'm on a diet. This is a hot fudge sundae. I shouldn't be having it. And so she picks up her glass of water and pours it on top of the hot fudge sundae. That was the end of the hot fudge sundae. I share the story because temptations are so much. I mean, the normal thing would be, well, why didn't she just stop eating it? Like, let your dad eat it. Why did mom have to actually ruin the hot fudge sundae? Because when we're in the grips of temptation, particularly when we are depriving ourselves or disciplining ourselves or controlling ourselves, it feels like a deprivation. And when it feels like a deprivation, the temptation takes on a life of its own. Otherwise, you think, here is this well-educated, intelligent, wonderful woman. What's a hot fudge sundae got on her? Like, I mean, she's decided she's not going to eat anymore. She doesn't have to ruin it. She could just put down her spoon. But temptations take on this power of their own. I had to eat the chocolate. So that's our superficial layer temptations. Things we're going to take in that are going to make us feel physically good. Go a step deeper, and the temptations become things we're going to do that may not be physically gratifying or rewarding in the moment, but that are going to make us feel good later on. The temptation to cheat on an exam. We know it's wrong. Teacher goes out to use the bathroom, or teacher's back is turned. The smartest kid in class is sitting next to you. There's this overpowering temptation. I don't know the answer. Maybe I should just, while the teacher's not here, catch a glimpse. Temptation to cheat in so many other ways, to cheat on your taxes, to cheat. So many opportunities the world gives us not to be honest. There are things that we think are going to make us feel better. If I get an A on this exam, whether through merit or not through merit, I'll do well. I'll get into the right university. I'll get the right job. If I cheat on my taxes, I'll have more money. So every temptation looms itself over us with this hypnotic call that if you engage in me, you will feel better. The temptation to shop. We're walking down the street. There's a new dress, a coat, a sweater, a pair of shoes in the window, shouting at us, if you just wear me, own me, you'll feel better. We had no intention of doing it, but the temptation becomes overwhelming. There's a great story. The friend of a wonderful meditation teacher. So the meditation teacher shares the story of a friend of his who every day would go into this pastry store on the way to work, right when he got off the bus on his way to get to work. And every day he would get off the bus, go into this pastry store, buy these pastries, and then go to work. But then the friend decided to exercise discipline over his diet and to stop eating the pastries. So every day he would make this pledge, I'm not going to eat the pastries. But nonetheless, he found himself every day in the pastry store. And so he goes to the meditation teacher, a friend of his, and says, I don't know what to do. Every day I pledge I'm not going to buy these pastries. And every day, without knowing even what's happened, I find myself with this bag full of the pastries on my way to the office. And the meditation teacher says, well, one possibility is you leave your wallet at home. And the guy says, what? You want me to steal them? So this is what happens. I mean, they're so overpowering that even though we have an intention not to, even though we think I'm not going to do it. It's so powerful that if I have to, I'm going to steal to eat them. The trick or the answer, the solution, is not about controlling them. Because you'll control the pastries, then you control the cake, then you control the hot fudge sundae, then you control the alcohol, then you control the cigarettes, then you discipline yourself to be loyal to your spouse, then you discipline yourself not to cheat. It's constant. The universe is full, as the question says. Temptations are rocketing everywhere we look. The only solution is to understand that within I'm already full. The only solution is what we talk about, intellect. Not the intellect that you get in college or university or in books, but the real power of discrimination that makes us understand I am not my senses. I am not this chemical and electrical pattern in my brain that says eat or drink or smoke. That's what's going on in our brain. It's just a pattern. It's a pattern of electrical and chemical firing that has formed a neural circuit with our reward center. That's all it is. But every time we give in, what we're doing is we're telling ourselves, all I am is a light bulb. Circuitry goes up, I'm on. Circuitry goes down, I'm off. All I am is chemical and electrical patterns of behavior. No. We've talked so much over the last few nights about who we are, about the divinity of who we are. And the best way to overcome any of the temptations is not through discipline. It's not this, I'm not going to have it. Because today, as I said, today it becomes the hot fudge sundae. Tomorrow it's the cookie. The next day it's the cigarette. The day after it's the whiskey. But is to recognize, who am I? And this is where spiritual austerities come in. If you look at the Hindu tradition, the Indian spiritual practices, what you're going to find is so many practices of austerities. We fast. We stay up all night.
You're listening to OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single...
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Elia, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
Hi, this is Christina Ricci with RAIN. Every 2 minutes, another American is sexually assaulted. If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, you are not alone. Help is just a call or click away through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Please call 1-800-656-HOPE, that's H-O-P-E, or visit rain.org, that's RAINN.ORG.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
Welcome back to Inspiration and Transformation. I'm so glad to have you all back here with me. Pooja Swamiji, when he was young and in the jungle, spent 11 hours a day standing on one foot. Why? His guru was not in the muscle building business. You know, it was not that he was, you know, training Pooja Swamiji to win some sort of yoga competition or athletic competition award? Why do we stay up all night? The body needs sleep, we know that. Why do we go without food, go without water? Simply to teach ourselves that we are not just a stimulus response reaction. We are not Pavlov's dogs. There's a consciousness in us. There's a purpose of our life that is not just eat, drink, respond to instinct. And in our spiritual practices, that's where we gain that ability. We all know you're going to go back to eating again. We all know you're going to drink water again. We know you're going to sleep again. But the reason that we practice these austerities is to have the experience of my stomach is growling. It's sending all the chemical and electrical patterns that say eat. But today is my fast. I'm not eating. And the signals come, the temptations come, you smell the food. But you know, today is my fast. And what that does is it develops an awareness within that says, yeah, my body may be screaming for food, may be screaming for water, may be screaming for sleep. But I'm sitting up all night doing japa. It's Shivratri. It's Purnima. It's whatever day I've decided I'm going to sit up all night. My body may be screaming, but I'm fasting. And it's not about torturing the body. People think of penance and austerity as this way of torturing ourselves. No. It's simply to give us the experience of all of the neurons are firing. They're all saying, eat, drink, sleep. And I'm not doing it. And look, I'm still here. The wave comes, the wave that says eat comes, the wave that says sleep comes. I don't respond. And I'm still here. There is an I that is not the response to the stimulus. There is an I that is not just the feeder of my desires. And when we connect with that, then that stays with us through our lives, even though, of course, we go back to sleeping, we go back to eating. But just the awareness. You know, when I first came to Rishikesh, we have these prayers in the satsang hall in the morning from 5 to 6. And they're no longer compulsory because we have so many other yoga and meditation programs now that run at the same time in English. But at that time, they were compulsory. And I was not used to sitting on the floor. And it's an hour. And as I would sit, I could sit about 25 or 30 minutes before my knee and my hip started just screaming in pain. And most of the time what I would do when that happened was I would just change the cross of my legs or sit in a different position. But every once in a while, I developed a meditation technique of I will not change my legs. Doesn't matter how much it hurts, doesn't matter how much my hip is burning or my knee is screaming. I will not change my legs. I will not move. I don't care if I'm itching. I don't care if there's a fly on my nose. I will not budge. And it's an incredible experience, and it's one that I really recommend, even though normally in our meditation, if you need to change the cross of your legs, you do it so that you can go back to having your awareness be on your mantra or be on your breath or be on the divine. We don't want our awareness and our meditation to be on our knees or hips. But every once in a while, It's an incredible practice to just set an alarm and say, until this alarm goes off, I am not budging. Because what it does is, the pain comes, the itch comes, and you look at it. You don't push it away. And this is really the fundamental key that I'm getting at. When the temptations come, we don't push them away. It's not the, I'm not going to think about chocolate. Because then, as I always say, what are we doing? Thinking about chocolate. I mean, the center of my awareness is still chocolate, whether I'm thinking about chocolate or not thinking about chocolate. My consciousness is still filled with chocolate. If I say to you, meditate, but whatever you do, don't think about ice cream. Well, what are you going to think about? Ice cream. Even if what you're doing is not thinking about ice cream, your consciousness is now full of ice cream. So it's not about pushing that away. It's actually about recognizing it, seeing it, acknowledging it, but not giving into it, knowing it's just, it's a reaction. It's there, whether it's a reaction of my body, an itch to move my leg, to move my hip, to eat something, whether it's a temptation that's come because of the media, because of advertising. Whoever's given me this temptation, and whether it's a temptation just to scratch my leg, or smoke a cigarette, or drink alcohol, or cheat on my spouse, or cheat on my taxes, or whatever I'm tempted to do. We don't get anywhere by pretending it's not there. When we really, really win is when we can look at it, see it, and not be overpowered by it. And that was the technique I developed in my meditation, was instead of trying to ignore my hip or ignore my knee, I would literally turn that into my meditation. I would stare at, in my mind, at my hip that was hurting or at my knee that was hurting. And what you find is, when you actually look at it, the power becomes much less. It's very macho when your back is turned, shouting at you from behind your back. But the minute you actually turn around and stare at it, it's nothing but an itch or a pack of cigarettes or a piece of cake or whatever. And to recognize you are divine. We spent all of last night talking about that. You are divine. You are not a slave. Here's the exciting part. Habits form in our mind. This is what we call in spiritual semantics, we call it a sanskara. In scientific semantics, we call it a neuronal network or a neuronal pattern. And here's the exciting part. We can change them. If every time you are tempted to eat chocolate, you do, what you are doing is strengthening the pattern that says, when this network fires, I eat. Similarly, if every time you feel angry, you throw a temper tantrum, you're doing the same thing. If every time you feel angry, you slap someone, the Western model of psychology says, let it out. You need to get it out. You're not getting it out. It's not going anywhere. You can't, unfortunately, vomit out your anger or pain. People try, cannot do it. Doesn't get out. What it does is it lays an even stronger network and pattern that says, this is how I respond to anger. And every time you do it, you strengthen that network, you deepen that sanskara. And so the way not to do it is actually to lay a different sanskara. a different pattern. So instead of having a temper tantrum every time I get angry, I sit down, I close my eyes, I breathe, I chant my mantra. I take a walk in the park, I light a candle. Whatever I do. Put $10 in my charity jar. Let some charity benefit as I overcome my anger. Whatever it is, you lay a new pattern. And slowly, 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 that pattern becomes deeper than the previous one. And this is the way that we do it. Not by pushing it away or controlling it through discipline. Because all that does is it just causes you to contract. Then there's so many things in the world that you're contracted from. And spirituality is not about contraction. It's not about withdrawal. It's about openness. But it's about openness with the awareness that the path of divinity, the path of spirituality, the path of devotion, the path of yoga has so much more to offer. The joy I get from a piece of chocolate cake is nothing compared to the joy that I get in my spiritual practice. So it's not a path of renouncing joy. It's a path of experiencing a much greater one. And that's what we do. So it's not about pushing things away, but rather embracing something that is much deeper, much fuller, and much more real. And then the temptations just drop off automatically.
This is OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth radio is conscious living for your soul every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Like Baldwin with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip with the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with inspiration and transformation. Many people coming from abroad think that Hinduism is a polytheistic religion. You come here and you've got an image of this god and that god and this god, and we have this prayer to that god, this prayer to that god, this prayer to this god. Walk into any temple, a Sanatan Dharma temple, and you're going to see so many, dozens sometimes, of different statues, different images. And the priest will go by chanting the mantras or doing the prayers or doing the arati to all of the different divine manifestations. That gets misinterpreted. Let me repeat that. Misinterpreted as being polytheism. Hinduism is not a polytheistic religion. We do not believe in many gods. What we believe in is one God who is infinite and everywhere. And when God is infinite and everywhere, then there's an infinite number of possible manifestations or reflections. One way to think about it, none of the metaphors is perfect because when it's God that you're speaking about, obviously the words, which are finite, are not able to describe that which is infinite. The words which are two-dimensional are not able to describe that which defies dimension. But we sort of run circles around the truth, getting a little bit closer and closer and closer to it. So one way of thinking about this is you have the sun. And the reason it's not a perfect analogy is the sun, of course, is not infinite. But nonetheless, the sun is very big and very powerful. And as many different containers as I put on the ground are as many different types of reflections as I'm going to get. A container that is flat, or almost flat, a bowl type of container that's blue and ceramic is going to give me a very different type of reflection of the sun than a container that is glass and vertical and translucent. Same sun. Different reflections only because the containers are different. So God is one. There really is nothing but God. It's not just that we believe God is one, but we believe there is nothing but God, which is why, of course, the analogy is not perfect. But that one nothing but God is being manifest, seen, perceived in an infinite number of different containers. There's another line also from the Upanishads that says, Isha vasya midam sarvam yat kincha jagatyam jagat. And what it means is everything in the universe is pervaded by the divine. There is nothing and no one that is not pervaded by the divine. And these are not just teachings that we read and we say, oh wow, and then we go and, you know, have dinner and fight with our family and watch TV and go to sleep. These are teachings for how we should live. You sit with your Upanishads in front of you and you chant or you listen to a katha or you go to a lecture. Well, the whole point of that is it should change how I see things. If we are talking about there being nothing but God, that doesn't say anywhere, everything is God except my boss. Everything is God except my mother-in-law. Like there's no scripture that says it like that. If everything is God, then everything is God. And that also includes me. And that may be stating the obvious, but sadly, most of us actually tend to forget ourselves most in the equation. We meditate on compassion. We meditate on loving kindness. We look for God around us. We try to practice compassion. We try to practice love. And then what do? Oh my God, you are so stupid. Look, you're trying to practice love. How dare you yell at that person? You're horrible. You're worthless. You can't even do this spiritual thing right. We berate ourselves. We're negative to ourselves in the name of compassion and loving kindness. Well, who you are is also not left out of the equation. So it's not everything is God but me because I'm worthless. And the teaching is, how can I live and really, really see that? It's obviously not easy, but we have examples. I mean, if you study the life of saints like Paramahansa Ramakrishna, for example, there's beautiful, beautiful stories in from his life of him literally bowing down on the ground in pranam to prostitutes. And people would say to him, what are you doing? You're a holy man. These are wicked women. How could you be prostrating to them? And as tears pour down his face, he would reply, but they are the mother. They are the goddess. That's really seeing the divine. And what it requires us to do is to focus on essence rather than form. So it's like going back to my son example for a moment, rather than focusing on the container. And if I point over here and the sun is reflecting and I say, what is this? Well, you could say, that's a blue ceramic bowl. Or you could say, that's a reflection of the sun. And in our lives, what we tend to do is we tend to say, that's a blue ceramic bowl. Who are you? I'm female. I'm white. I'm 45. I'm American. I'm a sannyasi. I'm a PhD. These are my parents. This was my life. This is how much I weigh. This is how tall I am. This is what I'm allergic to. This is what I like and don't like. It's like saying, what is this? It's a blue ceramic bowl. No, it's a reflection of the sun. The bowl is just the vessel. And so what the teaching is, who are you? You're the divine. Yeah, this is a vessel. You can't see the sun reflection in the air. You need a vessel. The sun is such that until and unless I have a vessel, I cannot see the reflection on earth. And here, with our eyes, we only are able to see God in form, with these two eyes. This is why when we talk about our third eye, you know, so many people ask, why do we put this tilak here? Like, what does that mean? Well, one of the aspects of it is it reminds us, oh God, when I use these two eyes, what I'm able to see is only form. I can see hair color, skin color, height, weight, clothes, fat, thin, ugly, beautiful, female, male. But that's illusion. And this chakra here is actually the energy center of the power of discrimination. And it's the power to discriminate truth from untruth. And the truth, that capital T eternal truth, is that we're divine. And so when we put the tilak on or when we do meditations for the third eye, the point is, oh God, let me see from this eye rather than using these two eyes, which just keep feeding me falsehood after falsehood, separation after separation, form after form after form instead of essence. Oh God, I want to see content, not form. I want to see essence, not form. I want to see you, not the package. I want to see the truth. And the third eye is the energy center, the Agya Chakra, that's the center for that power of discrimination that says, no, this is not female 45 white American sannyasi. This is divine. And what that means is that there's no separation between you and me. If we're looking only from that which is false, from this physical being, then you and I are separate. You're an object. I may love you, I may hate you, I may want to bring you into my life, I may want to push you out of my life, but either way, you are a separate object. When I'm able to use my third eye, when I'm really living that awareness of there's nothing but God, there's no separation, there's no place I end and you begin. It's all God.
This is OTR-FM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
The number one reason girls drop out of school in sub-Saharan Africa is lack of access to feminine hygiene products. The Pads for Schoolgirls Project, an outreach of Humanity Healing International, is changing this paradigm by setting up sewing programs at schools, teaching girls a vocational skill, while producing the reusable pads that help keep them attending classes. The girls pay it forward by making and giving pad kits to other girls in need. To learn more, visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Aliyah, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
When I broke my foot,
for leaving me alone when I wanted to be alone.
And now, as a grown-up, I'm thankful for being able to take care of you, my dear mom, for taking you to your therapies, for understanding that sometimes you simply want to be alone.
Roles change without us noticing. That's why AARP gives you the information to provide even better care for your loved one. Visit aarp.org/caregiving, brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati, and thanks for coming back and joining us for more of inspiration and transformation. There's a great story of what happens to so many of us when we embark on the spiritual path and we start to get bits of this knowledge of a guru when he had disciples and he was teaching this exact same teaching to his disciples. Everything is Brahma, there's nothing but Brahma. So two of his disciples go into the city one day, and as they're in the city, there's a big shout that there's an elephant coming, and the man who takes care of the elephant, the Mordat, who takes care of the elephant, is shouting, "Get out of the way, get out of the way, elephant's coming, get out of the way." And the disciple thinks, well, my guru says everything's God. And so I'm going to just stay here because this elephant, well, it's just an illusion. It's really Brahma. It's God. And I'm really Brahma. I'm not just this weak guy. So why do I have to get out of the way? So the elephant guy is screaming. Mahavat, that's what they call him, Mahavat, screaming at him, get out of the way, and everybody's trying to pull this guy out of the way. He says, no, it's all good, it's all God, no problem. Elephant, of course, comes and picks him up in his trunk and tosses him, you know, hundreds of yards, and he falls and breaks every bone in his body. And finally, his fellow disciples catch up to him and find him broken and bleeding in the grass. And he says, I hate our guru. Our guru is horrible. Look, he gave us this false piece of information. That was a horrible elephant. That was not God. I'm never going back to the guru's ashram. So the disciples go back. They tell the guru. They all come out to finally they find him with their lanterns in the night. And the guru comes and the disciples very, you know how our ego just locks us up in these ridiculous states. So the man is locked up in one of those states And the guru says, "Kya hua? What happened?" And the man says, "I was just trying to implement your teaching. You are the one who said everything is God. Look what this elephant did to me." And the guru says, "Ah, but you didn't really implement the teaching." And the man says, "What do you mean? I was seeing the elephant as Brahma." And the guru says, "But what about the elephant man who told you, get out of the way? What about all the people who tried to grab you and pull you out of the way? I told you everything is Brahma. In your ego, you decided it was just going to be you and the elephant. But you left out the elephant man, you left out all the people, you left out your fellow disciples trying to help you." And this is what happens, sadly, to us, is we tend to develop these very narrow views. Aham Brahmasmi, I am God, therefore you should do the dishes tonight. Therefore you should take care of me. Well, if I'm God, then so are you. Because God doesn't play favorites. There's no God who says, "Well, I'm going to be one with you, but not with you." When there's nothing but God, there's nothing but God. And so as we implement these teachings in our lives, it's really, really important to remember that. And again, of course, it's not easy. It's not easy to move through the world remembering that. And that's why when we think about the level on which we live, we have to remember that, yes, that is the ultimate highest truth. And yet, there is also the creation. There is the creator, and then there is the creation, and that's us. And yes, at our core, we're God. There is nothing but God. But as the creation in this Leela, this beautiful, incredible, divine drama that God has created, we have hearts that love, and we have minds that think, and we have the ability to have compassion, and we have the ability to reach out a hand. And one of the real tragic pitfalls of a superficial understanding, or rather a superficial implementation in our lives of these truths, is we tend to just use them. Well, everything's God, so why do I have to do my homework? Everything's God, so why give charity? Why pay my taxes? Why do anything? I mean, if it's all perfect, if there's nothing but God, why do I have to set an alarm and get up early in the morning and meditate and pray? I mean, I'm already God. And it really lends itself to very challenging games of the ego. So what I have found personally is it's beautiful to hold that truth, to remember that, to know that that is the highest level of truth. But it's also helpful to remember, well, when I can't live in that every moment of every day, let me at least live in my humanity rather than live in simply a pushed away humanity because, well, everything's God, so I might as well have a beer and watch the ball game. I'm like, what's it matter? And that's a pitfall we don't want to fall into. And so when we think about existence, one way is, you know, you've got like the old TVs and how they had dials that would actually turn from one channel to another channel. And if you think about it, like on the highest channel, the all-encompassing, truest, real channel, it's all God. But then on another channel, we're here in this human form. And this human form has the ability to do things like smile at each other, hug each other, help each other, make laddus and feed each other, use our talent and our ability to serve each other. And we don't want to dismiss that. Because one of the things on a personal level that has always felt very real to me is God is perfect. Otherwise, wouldn't be God. And if God had wanted us to just disconnect entirely from the world and to just know, okay, there's nothing but God. Let these people suffer. Let them die. Let this happen. Let that happen. No problem. It's all God anyway. If that's what God had wanted of us, I do not believe we would have been born with the ability to experience empathy, to experience compassion, to cry at the plight of another. I do not believe that our instinct would be immediately, before our brain processes it, to reach out and help someone who falls down in front of us. I mean, if you're walking down the street and someone in front of you falls, you don't process it in your brain. Well, is it God? Is it not God? You reach down, you help. And if we're trying too much to push away our humanity, then we're throwing away a gift that God has given us, which is our humanity. He's perfect. He gave us a human birth on purpose. We could have been a leaf. We could have been an earthworm. We could have been a tripod. I mean, it's all God. Why human? Why consciousness? Why love? Why intuition? So we use those as gifts from God, as an awareness that the perfect, all-knowing, all-powerful God gave them to us. And yet we hold in our awareness that the highest, deepest, truest truth is it's all perfect. It is all perfect. And yet we still reach down and help up the person who trips in front of us. Because that channel also exists as long as we're human. This brings to a close this hour of inspiration and transformation. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so glad to be together with you all each week, and I look forward to being together again next Thursday, same time, on Om Times Radio.